Today's operation is the frustration of Vietnam in miniature.
I shall not see.
The worst area we've been in since I've been in Vietnam. Awful sick, and I'll be so glad to go home.
And I will not accept.
As men clamored over one another, pushing aside women and children in their panic-stricken fury, members of the air crew dragged them onto the plane, trying to fill it as fast as possible.
The nomination of my party for another term as your president.
For it seems now more certain than ever that the bloody experience of Vietnam is to end in a stalemate.
This is Dr. Stephen Nurse. These episodes of Is Abled focus on the brave men and women who fought in the Vietnam War, not the politics that surrounded the war. This is The War in Vietnam, Part 2. Those who were there are still fighting because the jungle changes a man. Hello, this is Dr. Steve Nurse, and this is our second series on Vietnam. And our theme kind of for this is the statement that a jungle changes the person. And for this episode, we're going to interview Mike Dorsey. We interviewed Mike once before, but we were going to give him a second chance to see if he could do it right this time. And that's really not true. He did a wonderful job the first time. But when we first talked to Mike, we were talking about his experience with being on the helicopters and being a gunner on the helicopters. And I also found out that, Mike, how many you started out in infantry, is that correct?
Right.
And so how long were you in infantry before you went to...
I just about split it 50-50. Uh-huh. It was about 6 months online and 6 months with the choppers.
So was that by choice? Was that...
you got to volunteer for the... or at least from the infantry, you have to volunteer to...
And what helped you make your decision on that?
Well, I noticed with my keen observational skills that every day when the choppers would drop us off in the middle of the forest and then maybe pick us back up at night or whatever, I noticed that they left and went home, and we didn't. So I thought that would be a better place to be.
Better to be at home than not to be at home, yes.
Little did I know. But so I volunteered, and everybody promptly mocked me. Oh, that's ridiculous. You'll never get offline. They never let anybody offline. But amazingly, they did.
They did that. And you said you were, I think you said you were by Coochie. Is that where you were?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And so tell me what a typical day was like for you when you were.
Well, I was in stationed at what they call a fire base, which is a company of infantry, perhaps more, and then a battery of artillery. And then we had a big perimeter of, dug-in positions and concertina wire, three rows around. And that would be a fire base where you would hang, your safe spot. And then every day they would send the infantry companies out to various places in the woods where they thought we might be able to run into, the enemy out there, the VC.
So there was somebody that kind of gave you a heads up, or was it through plane? I mean, how were they getting the information there might be people out there?
Oh, I don't know how they got that. I mean, that would be your intelligence people.
Yeah,
Then from headquarters, we'd each get our assignment every day. So every day, you'd get up and go. The choppers would pick us up, and then take us wherever they thought would be, most likely spot.
And so there would usually be several choppers going to the same place, or?
Oh, yeah. There'd be the choppers would pick you up in a flight of nine choppers, and then various escort choppers, gunships, and stuff. But they would pick up the infantry. You go line up, and then you break up into your platoon size or chopper size bits, and the choppers come and land beside you.
You've got your full gear with you and everything at that point.
Full gear ready to go.
Okay.
And then they would insert us somewhere, and then we would sweep an area from whatever they gave us. So we'd start at point A, wind up at point B somewhere, and then the choppers would come back and pick us up. Mm-hmm. Unless, if we got into a contact situation, they would either pull us out or reinforce, depending on what.
So you headed up at what, 6 o'clock in the morning, or after a full service breakfast?
You bet, yeah.
Okay.
Rub down, you know.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, massage. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, did you come into contact very often, or did?
No, we had just a couple of skirmishes while I was there. I got there just after Tet, and was a replacement for I don't know how many it was, but we had the company had walked into a U-shaped ambush prior to my arrival and sustained a lot of casualties, and so I was a replacement for them.
Okay.
And I conclude that, you know, after Tet, looking back now, that the you know, the VC and whatnot had pulled back and kind of kept their heads down for a while, and I think that's kind of why there wasn't that much going on in my 6 months there online. Thank God.
So you mean U-shaped? They somehow got the troops to come into the middle of it, and then they were surrounded and
yeah. It's like your worst case scenario, kind of deal.
And I think that that's one of our one of the interviewers we had with the two guys that got the Silver Star, Burka and Adler, down at Fort Lewis. That's exactly what happened to them.
Is that right? Yeah.
Somehow there was Viet Cong or Vietnamese that kind of got in the middle, and two or three of them kind of ran, so they went after the people, and then pretty soon the guns came up around them and started shooting. Were there times when you were much more apprehensive than others, or you just kind of, or were you nervous when you went out in the morning? Were you, what were you looking to expect?
Well, you know, you mentioned naivete a while back when we were talking, and I have to say, up until, you know, for the first month or two, we didn't have any contact. So each day was a helicopter ride, which was really pretty much a blast because they would fly really low. I'm talking 40 feet. 50 feet, 100 feet at, you know, 100 knots with no doors, no safety belts. You sit there with your feet on the skid, ripping. It was exciting and fun. That was fun. And then we did a lot of walking, a lot of looking, and not much finding. So it wasn't very anxiety producing. It was more just grunt, tedious, you know, which is actually, I think now that I'm older, they say that's what really, you know, being in the Army is a lot about. It's, you know, like they say with pilots, it's 99% boredom and routine and 1% terror, you know. And so ours was, you know, it was a little bit along those lines. But I was fortunate. We got sniped at. We had a couple minor firefights. And I got close enough to hear bullets go whizzing by, which is very anxiety producing.
Yes.
Situation. And but was so I never got to the point where I was really afraid to go out. Like some people were in so much contact that they were like every day you just never knew what was going to happen. And my situation was not like that, fortunately. Yeah, we did all the stuff, but it just never
happened. And it's interesting, too, of course, that's, you know, one of the reasons that, you know, they say the military takes young people because, you know, you will follow directions, generally. And number two, you kind of have a feeling of immortality. I mean, when you're growing up until you're in high school, I mean, you very rarely saw anybody that was... dead, you know, unless it was grandpa or grandma in Iowa, you know. And in fact, we even never even got a call, a long-distance call. If there was a long-distance call from Iowa, we knew that someone had usually passed away or something was pretty serious, you know, going on. How was more, what was, so you when you were in the helicopter, you went back every day. What was morale like? Was it boring? What did you do? Did you...
In the infantry, I thought morale was very good. We were all pretty, you know, everybody's pretty upbeat. There was no, I mean, there was a certain amount of anti-war sentiment there, you know, a fair amount, mostly from along the point of view of what the hell are we doing? Kind of thing, but it wasn't a political thing. But there was, the idea was to get in and get back home.
Yeah.
Not to, I don't think there was a lot of sense of victory. We're going to achieve a victory. It was more like a get in, don't get shot up too bad. And,
exactly.
Kind of thing.
Did you, I also understand that, you know, I think I read something that there were as many people that were, well, I would not. The wounded is not the word, but that were incapacitated by things like malaria and bug bites and everything else is.
There's a lot of that. Armies lose a lot of people. You know, up to even in the not that long ago, you could lose 40-50% of your army to disease and all of that kind of stuff. But no, the U.S. Army takes good care of their people, good food, good medical attention and whatnot, and very little infections and that kind of stuff that I saw.
Yeah, well, I know that, you know, in the book, Germs, Gun, and Steel, I don't know if you've ever read but that's one of the things it says. It's not, you know, it's not who has the biggest army, it's who has the cleanest army and, you know, feeds their people, and so that you're, you know, talking about, you know, crossing the mountains, you know, and that was really important. And of course, once you had large encampments, then you had more issues with sanitation and all that kind of stuff.
Oh yeah.
And of course, you always were in pretty small groups. It sounds like when you went out, when you hit a landing zone, was it something that was prepared? Did they just kind of blow up the place so that there were no trees around or did you just land any place?
They would, you have to pick some place that doesn't have much, gives you room to get in. There lots of fields and, you know, rice fields, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Or no fields at all, just it wasn't or cultivated. See, they just drop you in the grass.
Or you can see stuff at least around you.
Yeah, you can see the helicopter is not going to hit a tree, so good enough.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, that would be a good thing, yeah.
Yeah, and then they touch down, everybody jump off and run out, take your position.
You always see them jumping off from like 4 or 5 feet or something like that.
They try not to do that.
Yeah, they try
mostly to they'd get, yeah, they get their skids on the ground.
Not
for long, but they'd get down there.
Get down and get out as fast as...
Because it can go bad, you know, so people don't want to hang around.
Course, you bring the helicopter noise in, and that's certainly attractant to people, you know, that the enemy knows there's someone around, that's for sure.
That's right, and it's a big, fat, slow target, too. So.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, that's right. A helicopter is certainly that way.
Yeah.
When you went out for a full day, did how much did you carry with you? Did it depend, or was there, I mean, you can carry a certain number of...
Yeah, well, kind of the life of the infantry guy is it depends on what kind of weapon you have, you know, if you've got, but you always carry, you've got a ruck with, you know, food, water, seems like there's a certain amount of first aid supplies, and then ammunition, and then sometimes you'd carry an extra belt for the guy with the 60, the machine gun, because they have to have everything on a belt, and
right.
stuff is heavy. So
pretty much all, it's all metal. I mean, you know.
Sure is.
Yeah.
So the guy with the 60, that's heavy in itself, and then maybe he'd have a belt or two, and then we would kind of split up the rest so we could carry a lot more for him. And, yeah, that's pretty much what you carry, probably about 40 pounds-ish.
When you were in the infantry, was that during the wet season or the when it, tell me about the – don't they have kind of like a wet season and a dry season and a –
You know, they do, but I don't, you know, I have so little recall of the weather, oddly enough. I don't remember it being really, really hot, though I'm sure it was. I don't remember, I mean, it just, I don't know, that blanked on me, but I arrived in country January 68, so what would January be for them? That would be kind of winter, I think, which is very pleasant by our standards, you know,
right.
80s, not too much precip.
Yes.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's in Kihei right now, and on Maui it's about 82 or 84. So
yeah,
very pleasant.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
So many of the people said that when they got there, that that was the first thing that hit them was the weather.
Oh yeah, it's nothing like Kittitas County. at all.
Yeah, I'm sure. thank God. Since I spent 21 years in Kittitas County. Did you have R&R? Did they send you any place? Or did you just stay there most of the time?
No, I was there. Well, you know, you got to be at what the precise requirements are, but I got two. I got to go to the Philippines. I chose the Philippines and Tokyo.
And were they, so, I imagine you were probably well treated there.
You know, I was well treated, but again, along the lines of naivete, you know, I grew up in Kittitas County in Ellensburg, same you, and I didn't even know there were places like that. I mean, I knew Tokyo existed, but I had no idea the magnitude of the thing. I knew Southeast Asia existed, but I had no idea what life was like there and the people and the language and so forth. And the same with the Philippines. So all of it was just like a mind-blowing experience. I didn't know they did that. I didn't know.
Yeah.
A lot of that.
Yeah. All we learned was from Arlie Bansal, right? World history.
Yeah.
That's true. What are the memories that you bring back with you? What are the things that you... Tell me something that you didn't... Well, that's something you didn't expect, but when you were in country in Vietnam... something that you didn't you were surprised to see, or that shocked or amazed you.
Well, everything was a little bit surprising. Again, just the countryside is so different, the people are so different, and culture and everything that happens is so completely different. That was all surprising. I think what really got me was the first time I came under fire, you know, actual fire, somebody really trying to kill you, kind of thing. That just surprised the shit out of me. I had no idea that even existed. You know what I mean? You don't. It's just not in one's realm of experience.
Did you always know who you were fighting against? I mean, people said that, you know. Were you apprehensive of just about everybody you ran into, or?
No.
Okay.
No, not particularly.
Okay.
Like civilians wandering by going to do like a suicide bombing. And thank God they didn't do that kind of crazy stuff.
Yeah.
That wasn't their thing. You know, booby traps and stuff.
Yeah. Did you run into other things like did you see the booby traps and those kinds of things, or were there people that were much more knowledgeable in how to avoid those things, or maybe you don't walk on the trail or you walk off the trail, or you know, those kinds of things?
You know, that is a good question, and unfortunately the answer is no. I walk point a lot, and I'm just wasn't, you know, we're not trained. You're just your point. And, yeah, watch out for booby traps. And there'd be a little, there wasn't much lore. It's all by lore, you know. You don't learn it. You are alerted to it, but you don't really learn it.
Yeah.
Unless you're there and in it, and there's somebody to kind of guide you. And, like, I don't know where whoever it was would have guided my platoon was. Maybe they got killed, and the point man usually gets killed. So that's probably what happened to the lore in my platoon.
Yeah.
So I just think whoever, every time I think about it, that I didn't, I would have easily walked over a booby trap or into a, you know.
Yeah.
Bad situation out of...
Well, it's interesting because, you know, the different movies that I've seen, you know, Full Metal Jacket, what else? Platoon. Mm-hmm. There's always some old guy that's, you know, been around and he's got all the scars and, you know, he helps the young cherries, you know, look out for this, look out for that.
Yeah, that guy's... not there.
He's not there. No.
He's with the other company or something. I don't know what happened to old.
Maybe he's a float. He's a floater. He floats around.
Plus, what would you be doing at that age in the infantry? It's a little just another side.
I mean, there were a few people that that I noticed that were like, 26, 28, or maybe had been in the service for a while and wound up going there, but. But really, in Vietnam, it was mostly guys your age, you know.
That, very young. I look at those pictures, and I can't believe how young and good-looking and slim we all were. We were just kids,
I think of you as on the tennis courts at Ellensburg High School, you know.
Yeah.
So it is interesting.
That's the crazy part of the whole thing is, you know, you're a cog in the wheel and a pawn in the game. And the experience of being a pawn, you know, where you have to, you know, the rubber meets the road only at certain points, as it were. For every guy online, there's at least 10 people behind him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the real contact only happens in certain places at certain times. You know, it's not everybody. Just that experience of, you know, seeing for myself that happened and being in, you know, a cog in the wheel that, you know, the mission is to find and engage and destroy and kill whoever is assigned to you to do.
That's the ultimate objective.
That is the objective.
Yeah.
And to be a part of that cog and that wheel was very enlightening.
Mm-hmm.
I just say it's a really poor way to solve problems.
Did you in your unit? Did you have people from all over the United States, or did you meet people from all over?
Oh yeah, everybody. That was the fun part about the draft thing too. Is it was a smattering of people in all kinds of orientations. Whereas now it's all volunteer. You kind of get people that are pretty more directly gung ho. As it were, than I think they were back in our day.
It's interesting because, Emma Amiad, one of the things that she said was that's one of the big differences that she sees between the military then and the military now is that when there was a draft, you got a much wider range of people with opinions and for war, against war, conscientious objectors. I mean, and whereas she made a good point, and she said, whereas now you don't when you choose to go in the military, you don't choose to go in the military as a conscientious objector. You know, you know, that's because you can get out of it if it's that way.
Yeah.
And, so, do you keep in contact with anybody? Or have you ever met there? Or
a few guys.
Uh-huh.
We have a. There's a website we have a C-322 website. Must be C-322.com or something, as I recall. Mm-hmm. So there's a website. They have an annual get-together somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Have you gone to any of those?
No. No, I've never felt the desire to do that. It could be that since I only spent 6 months with each unit, I didn't get as heavily invested, you know, as some people did. But I stay in contact with a couple people. They show up every now and then. They're all getting older, which is kind of sad.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
We are getting older. That's for sure. And did you have any issues with Agent Orange at all? I mean, sounds like no, probably. But
like I was telling, I think I told you once before, I had a lot of symptomology, you know, tingling and buzzing and tingling in my lower extremities.
Neuropathy, yeah.
Neuropathy, yeah, peripheral neuropathy kind of deal. Uh-huh. And I went to the VA, who were very accommodating, but we sort of decided I probably wasn't in an area where there was Agent Orange, though, so I kind of backed up. So I still have the symptoms, not nearly so severely.
As some people,
but that could just be me.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Well, you know, as far as I know, I mean, some of the folks that I interviewed that were on the air bases, that were repairing helicopters and those kinds of things, some had lots of issues with that, and others that were in the same kind of location, even the same air bases had, very little issues. So I guess it all depends on, a lot about, your own person. And
well, so I know some of the areas were really heavily bombed with that stuff, right? And I don't recall that the areas where we were in had been defoliated or attempted to defoliate them. But I've seen the pictures, and I know some of them are just dumping it on there. And whoever had to sweep through there the next day or whatever, that must have been.
Yeah.
I can see where they easily
be. Well, and I saw pictures of them. They would drop them out of the back of a C-130 or something, but just pretty much, and would show the troops taking, you know, two or three guys lifting a 50-gallon barrel of this powdered stuff into a big bin that would then,
no safety, no nothing by today's standards,
COVID-19 masks.
People would be wearing hazmat suits today.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so when you so let's just talk real quickly here. We've got a couple of minutes. How were you treated when you came? Did you come back to Ellensburg? Where did you come back to when you came back to the States?
I came back to Ellensburg, and I didn't stay there too long, maybe 4 or 5, 6 months, and then I moved to Seattle after that. I didn't have any particular troubles like you see reported.
Yeah.
I seemed to blend right in. I had a certain...
like you said, probably your good looks, and, that is...
Well, that's carried me a long way,
as you know.
But
it wears out after 70, though. I can tell you that. Right.
Yeah, it's harder to hold it up. But I had a certain anti-war sentiment in my own heart at that point. So, I think whoever said that kind of thing to those people was way out of line. With the troops coming back and calling them baby, whatever. If all that stuff really happened at a large scale, they were way off base. But yeah. It was a terrible thing to do, but I personally didn't have any problems with it.
Okay. Well, that just about closes us up for this episode, and we'll have one more. And thank you, Mike, for coming. And
thank you, Steve,
and bringing your beautiful presence with you. And we are out of here.
But it is increasingly clear to this report that the only rational way out then will be to negotiate. Not as victors, but as an honorable people who lived up to their pledge to defend democracy and did the best they could.
April 30th, 1975, was the official end of the war in Vietnam. But to say it was the end of the war would not be giving all those who participated their earned respect. The collateral damage continues and causes suffering to this day. Dr. Steve Nurse, signing off.